What's up, everyone? Welcome to No Filter. I'm your host, Anna Kasparian, and we are doing a housing-themed episode today. This is an issue that is incredibly important to me. I've covered housing-related issues on this show ever since it started. But today, we're actually gonna have a special guest on. He is a candidate, a congressional candidate for New York's 12th district, and he is also a housing activist. His name is Peter Harrison, and it is a pleasure to have him on this show. Peter, thank you so much for joining us.
Anna, thank you so much, and thank you for covering housing as much as you have been. You're one of the few people that have been putting light on this issue, so thank you.
Thank you. That's a huge compliment, and I'm really flattered. Now, it's an issue that's so important to me because it's a visual issue. We all see it. We see the homeless population really exploding over the last decade. In Los Angeles, where I live, there are tent encampments all over the place under freeway bridges. It used to be really isolated to the Skid Row area, but now it's everywhere. And this is a problem that impacts every single one of us because a lot of people are one paycheck away from ending up on the streets. And so I really want to talk to you about what you're proposing, because your proposal is incredibly comprehensive. It's ambitious to say the least, and you are proposing it in a district that Donald Trump actually won. So tell me, tell me about your homes guarantee plan.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, for me, I've been in this district for 13 years. It was up until a couple weeks ago, the home district for Donald Trump, but I guess we scared him off down to Florida. Mm-hmm. But my experience personally with housing insecurity, I've actually had to fight multiple bogus eviction notices, sudden rent hikes, and all kinds of harassment. So that's what really activated me in terms of housing policy. So I take a lot of that very personally as well, and those experiences in housing court and seeing the homelessness crisis as well. So I'm really proud to have been a part of and now running on the Homes Guarantee, which originated in People's Action, which was a really one of the first efforts that I'm aware of a really national movement to bring in impacted communities to write a housing plan from the bottom up. This is not a what does the real estate industry want? This isn't a what developers want. This is very much what home renters and struggling homeowners want. So this is something that I think is very big, very transformative, as you said, but I wanna stress it's very possible. It's just a matter of political will to do so. So I think really to start with, the key point to understand in all of this is that I think, you know, the housing crisis is not really just about housing. It's a crisis about capitalism in and of itself. And the fact is there's a lot of money to be made kicking people out of their homes. That will never change under a capitalist system. So where we really start from this plan is to say, okay, the market's not gonna fix this, it's part of the problem. So the five real big principles of the Homes Guarantee is from that lens to begin with. So the first one is to build 12 million deeply and permanently affordable homes outside of the housing market. The second is to prioritize social housing and public housing specifically. In New York City, we have the largest concentration of publicly owned homes. It's consistently maligned in the media. Tenants are often ignored in terms of their own activism in their developments. But largely speaking, public housing has worked. It's just been starved of federal funding and local funding. So we want to reverse that and build more public housing. The other aspect of this is protecting home renters and what we call them as bank tenants. In the housing movement, the idea that even if you have a mortgage, you don't really own your home. Mm-hmm. I think we learned this lesson from the Great Recession, where all of a sudden, you know, the market tanks and the banks come back and take your home and kick you out. So the idea of having a national rent control, as of right rent stabilization, just cause eviction protections, Section 8 benefits for everybody that is eligible for them. Right now, even if you are an eligible family for a Section 8 subsidy, only one out of four American households actually get it. And then on the homeowner, the bank tenant side of it, the idea again of protecting homeowners from eviction, the sort of pernicious cycle of, you know, the bank makes their commission, they get their loan, the federal government backs it up. If that person can't make that mortgage payment. See you later. You're out on the street. They flip it and they give it back. They get a second commission. The government still bails it out.
Right.
So the idea of protecting home renters to make sure they have a first right of refusal to make those payments, making sure that local non-market actors have a right to maybe take that home off the market if it is back on foreclosure.
I actually wanted you to elaborate a little bit more on, you know, what your proposal would do for individuals who have mortgages that might end up underwater in an economic collapse. You know, I'm not sure if you've followed this story, but it is something that we've talked about on No Filter. There are now more mortgages given out by non-bank lenders, which are not regulated by Dodd-Frank. And they are giving mortgages to individuals who have incredibly low credit scores. In some cases, they just went bankrupt and have no business taking out these loans. So what would your response be to some of the pushback you might get on that portion of your proposal? Because the argument, and I can just predict it right now, will be, well, these people had no business taking out mortgages. You know, they've done this to themselves. They had no right. What is your response to that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit whack-a-mole in this housing market system, because I think, you know, the first primary point is that the Homes Guarantee tries to have different fair lending practices to protect from the sort of non-bank lenders, to relax a lot of the subtle racism and biases within more traditional bank lending practices. So there are a lot of proposals to that point specifically. But you know, I think the bigger point, one of the bigger questions that I really want to raise, is why does the federal government care so much about creating homeowners? We've had 80 years of housing policy that have been based on this idea of a homeowner nation as some sort of intrinsically good or positive thing. And we end up running into these types of problems where we have a financial system, a built environment, even a social pressure to drive people into home ownership, which, you know, given the scale of the housing crisis and the affordability crisis and the climate crisis, is obviously a bad idea. Mm-hmm. So of course, if we don't address that fundamentally, we are just going to keep having these kinds of cycles where we relax mortgage lending, or we tighten it in one aspect of the financial market and some other shadier actors come in on the secondary market. So I that's always going to be a whack-a-mole issue. I do think the Homes Guarantee solves a lot of those traditional and non-traditional financial shenanigans. But the larger question here is, why have we been designing a system to promote homeownership when we know it has an immensely racist implication, very bad for the built environment, and has obviously been co-opted by larger financial forces? So that to me is a bigger question, and certainly one that I want to bring up in this election cycle.
So how exactly would your Homes Guarantee work? Let's say, you know, you're dealing with an individual who doesn't have a job, is unable to afford rent. Would you simply give that individual a home based on how your plan would work?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I think the basic idea is starting from a point of housing is a human right. So everybody deserves a place to live. You know, you mentioned the homelessness population in LA. Same thing in New York City, it has exploded. And again, we're in a period of economic growth for nearly a decade. So it is only going to get worse with the inevitable down cycle. So even to say that somebody that doesn't have a job or maybe is disabled, has other sort of addictions or disabilities, that they shouldn't have a home or we shouldn't provide them a home, A, that's cruel, but B, it's also kind of a waste of other resources. We can absolutely house everybody that needs a home, and we can absolutely do that with other providing other ancillary services around it. So I come at it from a very simple perspective that everybody that needs a home should have one. These are solvable problems. These are resources that we have, particularly at the federal level, to deploy to solve that goal. So, you know, this idea that if you're not a homeowner, you're somehow a secondary citizen, or if you need rental assistance or you live in public housing, you're somehow less of an American, or that you don't have a home currently or you're housing insecure, you don't have a right to a home. I think that's the larger question that we have to challenge, and that's very much what we're doing with the Homes Guarantee. You just challenge that perspective to begin with.
So we're about to go to a break. And when we come back, I do want to talk a little more about your proposal pertaining to rent control. But I do want to just make a quick comment before we do go to break. You know, my husband mentored a young boy, a young man now by the name of Dimitri. And you know, he grew up in a broken home, was in and out of foster care. And LA County literally just gave him an apartment. And I bring up his story because he has done incredible things with his life ever since. You know, the county told him, hey, we believe in you. We're gonna give you a safe space to live in while you look for a job, while you get your life together. And he is working on an incredible music career. He has made these incredible friendships, and just watching him build his life and build his career is so incredible. And I think one of the things that really turns people off to these ambitious proposals in regard to housing is I think a lot of Americans have kind of given up on their fellow Americans. I think they have bought into this notion that if someone has found themselves on the street, well, they did something to deserve it. But there are so many people who have lost everything because of medical bills. There are so many kids who grew up in broken homes, and they just need someone to tell them, hey, I believe in you. Here's your chance. And so I'm really grateful that there are people like you who are working on proposals like this. And when we come back from the break, we're gonna talk about it in a little more detail, especially the rent control portion of your proposal. We'll be right back. Welcome back to No Filter. We're here with Peter Harrison. He is running for a congressional seat in New York's 12th district, and he's also a housing activist. This is the heart of his platform. And Peter, I love what I'm seeing so far. I want to understand a little more how you would pursue rent control under your proposal, especially given some of the proposals that we're seeing from presidential candidates like Bernie Sanders. He would want to implement it on a federal level. But before we can get there, maybe we can do it on a more local level. So tell me the inner workings of this plan.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we'll start at the basic, you know, level of what rent control is and isn't. I think anyone that's taken, you know, an Econ 101 class, rent control is like the first lesson of supply demand and how bad putting artificial caps on pricing is. And it takes away the incentive to build new housing, or, you know, captures rent or value for renters. You know, this stuff has been ingrained in us, almost more of a religion than a science in America. But you know, there's a growing amount of research and sort of political context that questions that fundamentally. And the idea of protecting renters from increases, protecting them from landlords just saying, hey, I want to charge $300 more because I'm in a gentrifying neighborhood. You know, the cost of that at a city level or at a societal level is what we're seeing every day in the housing crisis. So just the fact that we're having these conversations are kind of remarkable for some of us in the housing movement. It's been a little bit lonely, but we're seeing this pressure in a number of states that are fighting successfully to get rent control in or strengthen the case of New York City with the Housing Justice for All Coalition that I've been a part of. So, you know, it's something that has worked. This was originally a federal policy, most famously during World War II, to protect the war industry workers. And this is something that, again, is a policy choice that can either say we could protect renters and make sure that money and their income isn't going to landlords and speculators and going into their communities and giving them opportunities to pursue other things. So, you know, we've done that in this country very successfully before. So it's not something that's radical or unproven. It's done been very successful elsewhere. In New York City, of course, it's probably the largest collection of rent stabilized. It's still probably less than half of the rental market, but it works. I mean, it's designed to protect renters from increases, protect them from harassment, from eviction. And that's a very successful program. And offering that to every renter is obviously going to have a lot of pushback from the real estate industry. But what we're really saying here is that we have to build more housing. I think everybody agrees with that. But the housing stock that we do have, we need to make sure that all of those gains are not going to speculators, whether they're Wall Street landlords or even foreign speculators. They have to stay within these communities and make sure people can afford to live in their homes. And you know, secure a future. So, you know, the conversation.
How exactly would your rent control proposal work? So for instance, in Los Angeles, if you have a rental property, anything that's built in 1974 or earlier falls under the rent control category. How would your plan work?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, for Bernie Sanders' plan, for the Homes Guarantee plan, there's a lot of similarities between the two. And the idea of, I think, rhetorically having a national rent control, that sounds like some scary, like DC-centric plan.
Not for me.
But it's, yeah, exactly. But it really, it's more about local control. It's about local circumstances. It also very much is intended to be a complementary policy tool in addition to building more publicly owned homes and social housing. So, you know, if it's just a matter of blanket top-down rent control, I think that still protects a lot of people. It gets a lot of bad actors out of the landlord market, but it still wouldn't fundamentally solve the housing crisis because we do need more housing. So I think that's a really important aspect of this. But I think, you know, how this would work in a city that, you know, like somewhere in Ohio or something that doesn't have any of these types of rules, you know, there's a balance of local input on this. This has to be something that is activated by activists on the ground and talked about at the policy level at a city or a state level. You know, Bernie Sanders has more or less said like a 3% cap or 1.5% of the consumer price index to give some flexibility for local conditions. The pressures in New York City and LA aren't the same as Columbus, Ohio or Youngstown, Ohio. And so there's a lot more local plug in and plug out of this process that I think is really important too. This is not a blanket solution for every part of the country. It's tailored to figure out what the housing needs are and what the housing crisis looks like.
Yeah, there is an interesting thing happening with rent controlled buildings in Los Angeles. So for instance, you have these big developers who want to snatch up all of these rent controlled buildings, not because they want the buildings, but because they want the land. And landlords are looking for a large lump sum of money. And when you have a developer show up and offer you more than the market value of that building, well, then the landlord is much more willing to sell it. And then they demolish that rent controlled building, build a brand new building, usually a high rise that has unaffordable units or condos, and then it makes the housing situation worse. So there are certain loopholes to rent control that I think are problematic. Have you thought about that when it comes to your plan?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and I think you talk on a bigger part of the Homes Guarantee as well as the sort of the land speculation side of this, because that's largely what we're talking about with real estate, right? I mean, a neighborhood certainly becomes hip and gentrified. Those prices, the land value goes up. That housing stock becomes much more attractive. The incentive to get those rent stabilized tenants out becomes much more attractive. And there's a lot of ways to do that, unfortunately, in most cases. So I think, you know, at the federal level, changing the fact that real estate is such a privileged asset class, it's taxed at a lower level, it's taxed at passive income, capital gains, we solve that problem to begin with. So the idea of it being a really attractive place for this kind of speculation, that's where we talk about decommodifying housing. My landlord in New York City in Stuyvesant Town is Blackstone. They're one of the largest private equity firms in the world. They're the biggest landlord in the world because you can make a ton of money off the land on these buildings. So that's kind of the big side of it. But the downside to the specific building in your case where, you know, somebody comes in and, you know, buys a building and demolishes it, I think in an ideal scenario, you have protection, one-to-one protection for those tenants to say either they have a right to buy the building, turn it into sort of a limited co-op. You have a guaranteed transfer, because in some cases, maybe it's a four-story building and maybe we can make that a 10-story building with deeply affordable housing. Like, you know, those are the kinds of trade-offs that we have to have at that micro level. But if we have that one-to-one guarantee that tenants always have a deeply and permanently affordable option, preferably in the same neighborhood, then I think we've got to give some ground for greater density, particularly where transit investments kind of produce that. So, you know, you can't just not build more, but we have to do so in a very deeply permanently social housing model.
Absolutely. So I want to move on to the issue of foreign investment, because there's a lot of money laundering happening in US real estate. You have wealthy business people from China and Russia buying up luxury apartments and condos, in some cases commercial real estate as well, in an effort to essentially launder their money. And this has been a big issue, especially in major cities like Los Angeles, like New York. And so is that something that you've looked into as part of your plan?
Yeah, very much for the Data for Progress work that we've done. And I can give you a specific example in Manhattan. It's a little bit outside of my district, but in Chinatown, there's a development that we sort of call Two Bridges. Extel is one of these major international developers. They built this just gigantic tower right on the East River flood line, but it wasn't even available to be bought by domestic American buyers. It was marketed and sold exclusively to Chinese investors. And you know, there were some capital restrictions that happened in mainland China in the last couple of years, so it's sitting kind of largely empty.
Oh my God.
So yeah, I mean,
that's so infuriating, Peter. You have no idea, because it artificially inflates property values nearby. You know, it's an effort to money launder. We're helping foreign governments money launder, and politicians who sign off on these types of projects need to be held accountable for it. It's disgusting.
I agree, and unfortunately, and one of the goals for my campaign is highlighting the fact that the real estate industry is very much implicated in a lot of very shady opportunistic behavior. And I think real estate money should be as toxic as fossil fuel money or pharmaceutical money on the left, because you know, you're impacting local communities, and Two Bridges specifically, you're triggering a number of secondary gentrification pressures and displacement pressures. And you're doing it by folks that kind of know how to game the system in terms of land use policies. They know how to game the tax code to incentivize buyers in international markets. A lot of these are LLCs that are anonymous. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's an entire system that feeds itself and throws a lot of money towards the political system at a city level, a state level, and at a federal level. So I think, you know, highlighting that and making any politician answer for real estate money is a big part of this cycle for a lot of different progressives running. But mm-hmm. I think fixing the tax code, making it impossible to have anonymous LLCs, making it impossible to have corporations, you know, in the real estate game. You know, these are choices. These are easy policy decisions. I don't know what the constituency is for defending LLCs being in condos other than some real estate lawyers and developers. So,
yeah,
you know, these
right.
are issues that I think a lot of Americans, whether they're living in cities, whether they're living in mobile park homes, like they're getting preyed upon by these same capital actors. So
absolutely.
Figuring that out is a big part.
Peter Harrison, thank you so much for taking the time to explain what you're proposing and to talk a little bit about your campaign. As I mentioned earlier, Peter Harrison is running for New York's 12th district for a congressional seat in New York's 12th district. Check him out on Twitter at Peter or Pete Harrison NYC. Again, that's Pete Harrison NYC. Thank you so much, Peter. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for watching No Filter. If you want to support this show, there's a very easy way to do it. Leave us a 5-star rating wherever you get your podcast. That helps to get this show featured. And you can follow us on social media at NoFilterTYT. Thank you again. And remember, never be afraid to speak your truth with No Filter.